It's time for another installment of our series, In Character, which explores fictional characters who affect our real lives. This morning, we'll talk about a character who causes kids to dash to their TV sets.
Let's go! Dora, 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 the Explorer!
Dora!
Who's that super cool Explorer, Dora?
We need your help!
For nearly a decade, Dora the Explorer has been part of the daily routine for millions of preschoolers and their families. The animated cartoon, which airs on Nickelodeon, is the most popular show for kids aged 2 to 5. Dora is a Latina, 7 years old, a leader, a problem solver, Spanish speaker. As part of the series In Character, NPR's Rolando Arrieta explores how Dora came to be.
Sharon Bennett of Washington, D.C. says her TiVo is clogged with recorded episodes of Dora the Explorer. But for her and her 3-year-old, it's worth it.
The tiny frustrating thing is I don't speak Spanish, so I don't understand everything. Sometimes she'll ask me what a word might mean or not, and I might not know off the top of my head.
Hola, soy Dora.
And I'm Boots.
We're at the beach. Have you ever been to the beach?
Dora the Explorer debuted in the summer of 2000. Nickelodeon had already been successful with launching interactive-type programming for kids, so they asked producer Chris Gifford to create another one. He says there were many attempts to engineer the ideal character that would motivate kids to participate. They tried a squirrel, a marten. One promising idea was a bunny.
It was a bunny who would go on a trip with his mommy. But it wasn't a bunny for very long.
That's because his boss, Brown Johnson, was thinking of something altogether different. She said, throw the bunny and all the other animal ideas away and make the character a Spanish-speaking Latina. Johnson had gone to a conference about media, race, and gender, where she learned that Latinos were not well represented in children's television.
One of our goals with Dora was to position the whole idea of being multicultural as being super special.
The notion of multiculturalism didn't start with Dora. Sesame Street, for example, has had an ethnically diverse cast since the 1970s. Nickelodeon had plans for an animated show where kids would go on a make-believe journey. Chris Gifford says along the way they would face obstacles and learn strategies to overcome them.
Like stopping to think.
Let's stop and think.
Asking for help throughout the show.
Who do we ask for help when we don't know which way to go?
Preparing information, then using it strategically, like through the story, through the journey.
The map! The map! The map, that's right.
These were basic to the conception of the show from the beginning.
But they still had a lot of questions. What would this Latina character look like? What would she wear? So Gifford and Johnson asked for help.
We must have more consultants than any television show in the entire universe.
School teachers, sociologists, historians, cultural and language experts were all brought in to help. And mistakes were made, like when they came up with the character Tico, one of Dora's friends.
Tico was always sleepy and sort of asleep under a tree. And our cultural consultant said to us, not such a good idea, you know, to have the Latino character who only speaks Spanish, who's the littlest character, always asleep. It's like, just not a good idea.
Plus, that might have angered the Costa Ricans, who affectionately call themselves Ticos. And as for where she would come from, the creators and consultants decided she would not be from anywhere.
We framed her as more of a pan-Latino character, so that she could actually be a source of pride and identity for anyone of Latino background.
Carlos Cortez teaches history at the University of California in Riverside. He's author of Children Are Watching, How the Media Teach About Diversity. He says being pan-Latina also meant the writers needed to choose Spanish words carefully.
For example, make certain that the words that we were using were universal Spanish terms and not Spanish terms that were meant one thing in Cuba and something else in Mexico and something else in Peru.
Lo siento. No sabía que el bizcocho estaba en el escalón. Caballito says he's sorry. He didn't know your cake was on the step.
So after about a year and many iterations, a smart 7-year-old problem solver named Dora Marquez was born.
I need your help. Will you check my backpack to find something that will make the bucket slip off the big red chicken's foot? You have to say backpack.
And why the name Dora? The Spanish feminine word for explorer is exploradora. Her last name came from the acclaimed writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And when it came time to sketching the way she looked, she wasn't your stereotypical Latina.
Short hair, not long, flowing hair, a little more tomboyish, because it seemed like, you know, a girl who was more interested in adventure and play and exploring than someone who thought a lot about what she looked like.
Gifford knew kids would like it. He and his team produced a pilot and showed it to a group of preschoolers.
I mean, you know, the kids were just so crazy about it.
Splash! Sploosh! I'm pretending to swim. I'm Dora the Swimmer.
Gifford says preschoolers screen all Dora episodes before they air. And they could be really tough because they tell it like it is.
Oh, it's awful. It can be so scary. The 3-year-olds come at you and you're just petrified.
As a father, Gifford believes that Dora the Explorer is what all parents want their daughters to be.
Well, she's courageous. She's kind. She's got unbelievable interpersonal skills.
Some parents might also find her a little annoying, like when she encourages kids to yell.
Say abre!
And Dora never fails.
We did it!
Despite all that, Dora the Explorer just might be the first icon for the children of a new America that today is about 14% Latino and fast-growing. Rolando Arrieta, NPR News, Washington.
Yay! We did it!
And if you've never met Dora, you can join her for a music lesson at our website. Just go to npr.org/in-character. If you can't find it, use a map. And while you're there, tell us about your favorite fictional characters. Your essay could end up on the radio. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. With Renee Montaigne, I'm Steve Inskeep.
Swipe it took our cake, but we found it. Hooray! Yay! Woo! Hooray! We did it!
When Kelly Greenman grows up, she wants to be a policy wonk, focusing on the policy details that might put the rest of us to sleep. She is 20 years old. She's a junior in college. She's poised and accomplished, and her passion is saving the world from global warming. NPR's Richard Harris first met her last December at the United Nations Climate Talks on the tropical island of Bali. This morning he brings us her story, part of our series Climate Connections with National Geographic.
Usually, UN climate talks are 99% tedium. Diplomacy, technical discussions, posturing, maybe, if you're lucky, a little progress. The International Youth Delegation at Bali, though, added a big dose of spice.
All together!
Bustle of the day, bustle of the day. Who is bad? Who is worse?
Each day at 6 p.m., they held a satirical awards ceremony to the countries who, in their view, did the most to obstruct the talks. And when the United States won that dubious honor one day, a fresh-faced college student named Kelly Greenman stepped up to accept the prize.
Why should America have to do what the rest of the world is already doing? It's not possible. We don't have the capabilities.
Kelly Greenman was clearly having fun with this bit of theater, but she didn't really travel to Bali to play for the TV cameras. She came to dive into the policy of global warming.
I think I get frustrated because I know people can do better, and I know that there's potential for change when strong people band together and make it clear that they want to make a difference. So maybe it's hope that drives that.
And she's riding high on that hope. She managed to sweet-talk travel money for this trip out of Washington University in St. Louis, where she's a junior. In her group house just off campus, she offers me a cup of tea.
The chai and vanilla almond are my favorite.
Her career actually started taking shape 13 years ago at her family's home in the Florida Keys.
I remember when I was 7 and my dad showed me the front page article of the Miami Herald about climate change. And it said something about how in 75 years, how I understood it was it said in 75 years the world was going to end. Now I'm sure the Miami Herald didn't print that. But as a 7-year-old, that's what I understood. And I just remember crying about it.
The fear wasn't abstract. The island where her family lives is barely above sea level. So when she was 10, a family friend who works for the World Wildlife Fund encouraged her to become a pint-sized activist.
she was the first person who sort of planted the idea of a youth environmental conservation group. And then just inherently in being in a place where the coral reefs are already being affected by climate change, it was pretty easy to latch on to a specific topic.
She started lobbying state and federal legislators about protecting the reefs and gradually turned her efforts to climate change. What really got her hooked on changing the world was a family trip during high school. Her father quit his local law firm so the Greenman family could spend 6 months backpacking around the world. Kelly says a day they spent at an orphanage in Kenya changed her life.
I think there must have been over 80 kids there, and they were all so little. I couldn't fathom seeing that and not doing something about it. And so sort of a side story is that out of that experience, my sisters and I started a nonprofit.
She and her sisters raised $20,000 to help those orphans. And she says the experience taught her two lessons. First, the world is full of people much less privileged than we are. And second, it's possible to help them. She applies the same principles to climate change.
For me, it's not only just an environmental issue, it's just a social justice issue. People in other countries are being affected by largely the actions of developed nations and largely the U.S.
Hey, what are you doing?
We head off across the Washington University campus on a blustery spring day, and Kelly catches up with some friends. She has a full class schedule in environmental science, but tons of extracurricular activities, too. She helps run a program that puts college students into local classrooms to teach about the environment. She's also giving a talk at a climate change teach-in later in the day.
Are you coming at 4:30, 45-ish?
8.
I think I speak at like 5.
Okay.
She's also a bit anxious to hear from the Truman Foundation. She's a finalist to win a $30,000 scholarship for grad school.
I have to stop checking my email because I've become compulsive about it. Just like, what if they wrote me today? Like,
okay. And between classes, she heads to the Career Center to make sure her applications for summer internships at environmental groups in Washington, D.C. really sing.
Hi, I have an appointment at 11 with Karen.
Counselor Karen Morton soon appears and leads Kelly back to her office. Kelly is chagrined to discover that Karen didn't have printed copies of the cover letters.
The last time I brought a copy and she had printed them out, and so then I was wasting paper, so I didn't want to do that this time. But I think I get frustrated by people who are gung-ho for conservation, but then are like, oh, well, but I just really like steak. And then, I don't know, because you can do more for the environment by not eating meat than by not driving a car.
Like, is that why you're vegetarian?
Yes.
She then proceeds to explain that globally, the transportation sector emits 17% of greenhouse gas emissions. Meat-related agriculture accounts for 18% of all emissions.
Sorry about that.
No problem. I'm sorry that I didn't.
Counselor Karen Morton comes back and reads over the letters. Kelly has a problem most students would envy. At 20, she already has too many things to be proud of to squeeze onto a single page.
It's a little long,
okay,
but you've got some really good background to bring, so I don't want to take out anything that's relevant.
In the end, there are just a few tweaks to be made.
I think they're good.
Yeah.
Nice job.
Thank you.
I think they're good.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I'll let you know how it turns out.
Please let me know.
Next class, a quick bite of lunch, and Kelly sets off to give her talk about Bali. Tedious as the conference was, that's the arena where Kelly thinks she can really make a difference.
I think it's obvious that my career is going to be more than 10 years long. I think it's frustrating, especially going to the UN conference and seeing that our leaders could be doing things so much more efficiently. So I wouldn't mind being a policy wonk for the rest of my life.
One reason she's willing to try a career that's so daunting is that she's still full of optimism about what she can accomplish and about human nature. She doesn't even blame her parents' generation for everything we did to put us into this mess.
I think it's important to recognize that you didn't always have the knowledge in the past generations that we do today in terms of the environmental impact of what's going on. And I like to think that if they did have the knowledge, then maybe they would have made different choices.
Have you developed a formula for saving the world?
No, I'm just kidding. No, not yet. I'm working on it.
And things are looking good for her. She finally did get that email, and she won that prestigious Truman Fellowship. Now she's hoping to hear any day about her summer internships. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This series has taken us around the world, and you can hear more stories in it at npr.org/climateconnections. which is where you can also get the latest features on global warming from National Geographic magazine. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's one of the slogans used to convince Chinese couples to have just one baby. Mother Earth is too tired to sustain more children. It's been 3 decades since the one-child policy was introduced, supposedly a temporary measure in China. But there is rising opposition amid criticism that the policy is creating a demographic crisis. NPR's Louisa Lim reports that the trends are exemplified in the city of Shanghai, which has the lowest birth rate and the highest proportion of the elderly in China.
Two-year-old Mao Mao is kissing her 10-month-old brother, Lulu, with encouragement from her mother. As brother and sister play in a Shanghai park, little do they realize they're a departure from 3 decades of strict family planning. Although many rural Chinese have 2 children, China still limits most urban families to just 1 child. Because Mao Mao and Lulu's parents are both only children themselves, they're among the privileged few city dwellers allowed to have 2 kids. I was lonely as a child, says their mother Zara, who didn't want her full name to be used. I was jealous of friends who had brothers and sisters. Now my friends are envious of my 2 children. Figures bear this out. One poll last year showed 69% of Chinese would support a proposal to abolish the one-child policy. Zara's come to the park with her mother-in-law and her mother-in-law's 81-year-old mother-in-law. All of them support China's efforts to control its population. Our leaders have thought a lot about the country's policies, the 81-year-old matriarch says. Whatever they say is right. However, demographic scholars aren't so sure. Some academics now believe the simplistic thinking behind the one-child policy could be responsible for a looming demographic crisis. Among them is Peng Xizhe, Dean of Social Development and Public Policy at Fudan University.
The major policymakers are only concerned about the total number of the population. But now China's population dynamics have become so complicated. On the one hand, we have the number is still growing. Then we have the very rapidly aging population. Then we have the issues of the bigger migration. And also we face the problem of the abnormal sex ratio at the birth.
That abnormal sex ratio means little Lulu might not find a wife, along with as many as 40 million other young men. The latest figures show 119 baby boys are born in China for every 100 girls, way above the normal ratio, because of the traditional preference for boys and the availability of abortion. The strict birth control policies have serious economic consequences too. China's limited labor pool and its aging population means it will eventually lose its position as workshop of the world, as Zuo Xuejin, executive vice president of Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences, explains.
Demographic trend is making China less competitive in labor intensive manufacturing. We cannot compete in future with maybe India, Bangladesh, in terms of labor-intensive manufacturing.
Indeed, the future of the one-child policy was a hot topic at this year's parliament session. But speculation that changes might be in the offing ended when Population Minister Zhang Weiqing said the policy would stay in place for another decade. The academics believe that's a mistake.
So in that way, I think that it's better to just let the family to decide how many children they want.
Fertility is a very basic right of citizens, so we should be very careful to interfere in this field in future.
One reason why they believe people should take control of their own fertility is China's rapidly aging elderly population. Here in the park, seniors far outnumber children. A staggering 20% of Shanghai's population is older than 60. Longer life expectancy and the one-child policy mean fewer workers are supporting ever more seniors. And the disintegration of a state-run social security network means many seniors now fear a lonely future.
I'm worrying when I'm older, no one take care of that time. I think my life will become very terrible. Our government never worried about that.
Wang Jintao is a teacher of the erhu, a traditional two-stringed instrument similar to a violin balanced on the knee. As he prepares for his weekly class in the park with a group of seniors, he believes he's voicing the fears of an entire generation.
30 years ago, our government made a mistake. So the result is in big city, most of people like my age, they worried about their future.
China's now galloping towards its aging future, and experts are warning the danger is not of changing the one-child policy too soon, it's of moving too late. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Healthcare has been one of the most debated issues in the presidential primary. As part of our coverage, we're going to look at the healthcare systems of other wealthy countries to see how they do it. Today, we begin with Japan and with an old friend of NPR, the journalist T.R. Reid. Reid's documentary, Sick Around the World, airs tomorrow night on PBS on the show Frontline. As Reid found out, Japan has universal coverage, but it spends half as much on healthcare as the U.S.
Japan produces cars, computers, and color TVs, but it also produces the world's healthiest people. It has the longest healthy life expectancy on Earth. That's partly due to diet and lifestyle, but the universal healthcare system here plays a key role, too. Everyone in Japan is required to get a health insurance policy, either at work or through a community-based insurer. The government picks up the tab for those who are too poor. That's a model of social insurance that's used in many wealthy countries, but it's definitely not socialized medicine. 80% of Japan's hospitals are privately owned, more than in the U.S., and almost every doctor's office is a private business. Dr. Kono Hitoshi is a typical doctor. He runs a private 19-bed hospital in the Tokyo neighborhood of Soshigaya.
Well, the best thing about the Japanese medical system is that all citizens are covered, anyone, anywhere, anytime, and it's cheap.
So, do they have to make an appointment to come?
No.
Never?
Never.
The Japanese go to the doctor about three times as often as Americans, and since there are no gatekeepers, they can see any specialist they want. Japanese patients stay in the hospital much longer than Americans on average. They love technology like scans. They have nearly twice as many MRIs per capita as Americans do. Professor Ikegami Naoki is Japan's top health economist.
In Denver, where I live, if you get an MRI of your neck region, it's $1,200. And the doctor we visited in Japan says he gets $98 for an MRI. So how do you do that?
Well, in 2002, the government said that the MRIs we are paying too much. So in order to be within the total budget, we will cut them by 35%.
So that's how they keep costs so low. The Japanese health ministry tightly controls the price of health care down to the smallest detail. Every 2 years, the doctors and the health ministry negotiate a fixed price for every procedure and every drug. That helps keep premiums to around $280 a month for the average Japanese family, and the employer picks up at least half of that, a lot less than Americans pay. And if you lose your job, you keep your health insurance. Japanese insurance plans are a lot more accommodating than American insurers. For one thing, they can't deny a claim, and they have to cover everybody. I asked Professor Ikegami if the insurers could turn down an applicant who had heart disease.
That is forbidden.
These health care plans covering basic health care for a worker and his family, do they make a profit?
No, because they are not allowed to make a profit, and anything left over is carried over to the next year. And if there's a lot carried over, then the premium rate would go down.
All right. Here's a country with fantastic health statistics, user-friendly insurance companies, no waiting lists, and rock-bottom cost. So who's complaining? Well, the doctors are. Dr. Kono says he's getting paid peanuts for all his hard work.
The treatment fee for a wound, anything under 100 square centimeters, that's 450 yen. The treatment fees are all listed here.
If somebody comes on the cut that's less than 6 square inches, so fairly small cut, he gets $4.30 to sew that up. Seems incredibly cheap.
It's extremely cheap.
Dr. Kono is forced to go outside the price book, looking for ways to make a yen. He has 4 vending machines in his waiting room. And in a part of Tokyo with free street parking, he charges $4 an hour to park at his clinic. The upside is that virtually no one in Japan goes broke because of medical expenses. Professor Saito Hiredo is president of the Nagoya Central Hospital.
In Japan, how many people go bankrupt for medical costs?
I don't know.
Just the question seemed bizarre to him. He checked to make sure he'd understood me correctly.
We never heard of it. Yeah. Almost never heard of it. Yeah.
While the patients may be healthy, the hospitals are in even worse shape financially than the doctors.
I think our system is pretty good. Pretty good. But no system is perfect.
Yes.
But now 50% of hospitals are in financial deficit now. So I'm afraid hospitals may be one of the endangered species in Japan now.
So here's the weak spot. While the U.S. probably spends too much on health care, the Japanese may be spending too little. In a country with $10 per night hospital stays, the prices are just not high enough to balance the books. Hospital prices too low? There's a problem a lot of countries wish they had. For NPR News, I'm T.R. Reid.
Tomorrow, how Taiwan created its universal health care and where it got the idea.
For most Americans who shop at IKEA for home items, the Swedish names may sound a little like this. That's the Swedish chef from the Muppets, but there really is an IKEA cushion called Mork. IKEA's product names have been the butt of jokes by The Simpsons. There's even an independent online game which invites users to guess what certain IKEA products are, with names like Björkus, Sloida, and Klunsa. In spite of those names, this chain is successful. And Deirdre Kennedy reports on the marketing phenomenon that is IKEA.
At the giant IKEA warehouse in Emeryville near San Francisco, customers wheel out baskets piled high with cheap furniture, lamps, and bedding. Most people who just dropped a couple of $100 at a store can tell you what they bought, but not at IKEA.
Do you know the names of any other products you bought?
I can't pronounce them. I thought one was called Amoeba, but it's not called that. It's A-N-E-B-O-D-A or something like that.
The name of the products? I don't know them.
Yeah,
it's right here. Yeah, it is Snile.
S-N-I-L-L-E.
Dudera, I think.
Rabalder.
What is that?
That is an extension cord, right?
It means bald guy.
That's IKEA's advertising manager, Matthias Jongard. So what does Rabalder mean?
I think the Swedish correction should be like a big fuss. It can create some attention, and then we call it in Swedish Rabalder. It's hard for me, you know, I come from Sweden, and I know how they are supposed to pronounce it, but nobody here understands what I mean.
Nobody, he says, includes his own coworkers. And the product names aren't just arbitrary. There's actually a formula for how the design team comes up with them.
For example, sofa should be having names from Swedish small towns like Karlstad and Kramfors. And can also be a women's name when it comes to fabrics and curtains. And, you know, we have a lamp and that's called Knubbig. And it's also slang for chubby.
That's chubby, as in fat and round. IKEA's naming philosophy recently kicked up a bit of a rabalder, remember, a big fuss, in the international press. A Danish journalist noticed that the company's floor coverings were named after Danish towns and cities. One headline said, "Denmark will not be Sweden's doormat." University of Copenhagen linguistics professor Klaus Köhler says no one in Denmark took it seriously and saw it for what it was, a friendly wink at the historic rivalry between Denmark and Sweden.
If you go hundreds of years back in the story, the Swedes have taken away quite a bit of Danish country. They're really teasing us very toughly. We are not going to burn down the Swedish embassy or, you know, demolishing IKEA stores here in Denmark.
That impish way of poking fun at its neighbors and customers and itself is all part of a marketing strategy that's paid off big time for IKEA. It now has more than 270 stores in 36 countries. Subodh Bhatt, professor of marketing at San Francisco State University, says the odd names also appeal to the same consumer mentality that chooses pasta al formaggio over just mac and cheese.
Part of IKEA's appeal, actually worldwide, I mean, apart from their low prices and decent stuff, is that they are in not just the furniture, but the second and I think the more important part of the appeal is that they are hip because they are from this Scandinavian place with very exotic names.
Making their product names unpronounceable for most of us hasn't hurt the company's bottom line. IKEA's founder, Ingvar Kamprad, is now the seventh richest person in the world. IKEA opens its newest store in Brooklyn in June. For NPR News, I'm Deirdre Kennedy. The Dalai Lama arrived in Seattle late last week to promote compassion. He found himself talking about confrontation in Tibet, in China, and along the path of the Olympic torch. Once again, Tibet's Dalai Lama is caught up in the complications of being both a spiritual and a political leader. And he carries the expectations of those who come to see him, including 55,000 people who filled Seattle's football stadium.
If some people have belief or view that Dalai Lama have some miracle power, that's totally nonsense. I am just one human being.
The Dalai Lama insists he's just a simple Buddhist monk. He's also the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize and the head of a government in exile who fled his land nearly 50 years ago after Mao sent China's army into Tibet. I asked him about that when we sat down to talk.
You spoke here in Seattle about March 10th, 1959, mm-hmm. and that was the week that you fled Tibet.
Yes.
March 10th of this year was the beginning of the demonstrations, mm-hmm. some deadly violence in Tibet. Has this brought back memories?
Of course, in both cases, people suffer a lot. And from March 1959 till September 60, the number of people who killed, 87,000. So, of course, now this time, not that much sort of casualty. But essentially, you see, many people are said they arrest, and the rest of their life going to be difficult. And if things continue as it is, then tightening control will increase. So, naturally, a lot of suffering, a lot of problems. And great damage about Tibetan Buddhist culture. So it's a much, much worry. But big difference is at that time, my own life involved, whether I can survive or not. All Chinese artillery is these aiming to where I live.
The artillery was headed right in your direction. You are still a target of the Chinese, verbally. Over the weekend, China's president said the conflict over Tibet is not an ethnic problem, I'm quoting him, not a human rights problem. He accuses you of splitting the motherland. What's your response to that?
It is quite strange. But okay, if they really enjoy to attack on me. Okay, enjoy it. People, I think, don't believe that. Even Chinese own people, I don't think. One, my sort of sadness is millions of Chinese, those innocent Chinese, who have no other way to access the situation, totally relying on the government information.
The media.
Then these millions of Chinese then really feel anger towards me, that I feel very sad. What's the way to tell these innocent Chinese brothers, sisters, the reality? But there's no way to send information or to send the news.
You have been very clear that you support the Olympics, that you do not support a boycott against the Olympics.
Yes.
But you also support people's right to demonstrate,
that's right.
Free
that's
speech.
Right.
You
provided strictly nonviolent. So freedom of speech is very important. Now, for example, among Tibetan and among our friend, some are very, very critical towards me.
They think you're too moderate.
Oh, yes. And for example, my own elder brother one time described me as a traitor.
To Tibet?
Oh, yes. He described, oh, my dear younger brother sold out Tibetan right. In history, you remain as a traitor. And also, even if some Tibetans are very critical about Buddhism, but you say, I never say to these people, shut up. No, I cannot say. It's their right to express what they feel.
That is a pretty extreme position to call you a traitor. What would you say is the reason for making Tibet's future as part of China?
Tibet, materially, backward. Meantime, every Tibetan wants modernized Tibet. It's their right. More prosperity, a better facility in education, health, and daily life. So in this respect, China becoming richer, richer. So therefore, remain within the People's Republic of China. As far as material development is concerned, we gain much benefit. Since we have our own unique cultural heritage, including our language, our script, these matters should be in the hands of Tibetan who knows about our culture, about our religion.
Although Tibet seems to be seeing its culture sacrificed, its entire culture seems
to be
in the process of being destroyed.
That's right.
Or overwhelmed by Chinese.
Yes. With this present arrangement, whether intentionally or unintentionally, some kind of cultural genocide is taking place. Defense, foreign affairs, of course, the central government should take full responsibility. Then the rest of local business should be in the hands of Tibetan. Autonomy is meaningless, just on paper. So we are appealing to the Chinese central authority, now give us meaningful autonomy. It is we deserved in the constitution. In early 50s, Chairman Mao recognized Tibet case as something very special. So if Chinese government keep that spirit, then these problems will not happen.
And with that, the Dalai Lama's aide signaled he was already overdue for another event at this conference called Seeds of Compassion. He gathered his cinnamon-colored robe around him and smiled his goodbye. I put to him this one last question.
Do you think you'll see Tibet again?
Yes, we believe. We believe.
Tibet's exiled spiritual leader, the 14th Dalai Lama, speaking yesterday in Seattle. Tomorrow we'll talk to a scholar of Tibet about China's response to protests there and around the world.